So tonight I'm going to give a talk on noting. And part of the reason to give this talk is to honor this very important instructions we have in our tradition where we do mindfulness practice with the naming, noting experience as it arises. And part of the motivation for me to give it is to also maybe to encourage some of you for whom it's appropriate to use to do noting to maybe throw yourself into it a little bit more wholeheartedly than you have as a way that so that you can get more settled or more fully engaged in your practice. So I say those kind of words, carefully avoiding the word progress. So I want to start by reading what I thought for me was a remarkable passage in Helen Keller's autobiography. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over my hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as something forgotten, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant that wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened in my soul, gave it light, hope, set it free. And I think we often forget, we've all forgotten, long since forgotten, what a remarkable miracle, a remarkable, amazing event it is to be, have words, to have names, to be able to have language and speak. It's one of the great, it's one of the special characteristics, seemingly, of the human species. Other species, maybe have it, we kind of don't know, and the biologists are kind of trying to figure out whether dolphins or whales, you know, really have language or not. But it's really a marvelous thing that that the universe could come to us, being able to name something that's external to us, and the name means something symbolically or has significance, so that other people can understand us what we're talking about. I say the word ball, and we all know kind of what a ball is, more or less. There's great varieties in balls, but we know it's not a square. Oh, I see. Well, there's us problems. But language is really an amazing thing, and the idea that Helen Keller says, you know, it gave my soul light, hope, it set it free. I think that it, to some degree, the ability for us to use symbolic language or images to explain and describe the world we live in is really allows us to live more fully in this world, to be engaged more fully, to have actually more intimate relationship with the world than if we had no language at all. Ability to name things creates tremendous opportunities for our lives. If we stop naming entirely, that ability stopped entirely, much of what we know as human life and civilization and culture would vanish like that. Much of our relationship with people. Now, as part of mindfulness practice, the naming is used as kind of an anchor to the present moment. It's all too easy. Some of the two of you mentioned, you know, how nice it is to have someone remind you and during the sitting to come back or to kind of wake up or pay attention. The mind wanders away all too easily into thoughts and fantasies and whatever. It gets lost and you're not really paying attention. You don't know where you are until you kind of wake up, is the expression. Having a habit of continually naming the experience as it's happening provides an anchor that keeps you centered, keeps you in the present moment. Because if you're actually naming what's happening in the present moment, to some degree you have to be present. And so if you have that habit of continually doing it in a gentle way, you're not going to go so far off. Because if you make a name every 2 seconds, at least every 2 seconds you're going to come back. If you don't name, it might be 5 minutes, 10 minutes or something until you kind of come back. And maybe you don't like the naming, maybe you think it's kind of like a strange thing to be doing this with the mind, but you have to, some of you are going to have to admit that your mind goes off for 5 or 10 minutes at a time. And maybe if you kind of had the continuity of the naming, you might stay present a little bit more often. In the simplest definition of this, what's called noting or naming, It's just a kind of very simple acknowledgement of what's arising in the present moment with an appropriate name. Now, the appropriate name doesn't have to be well considered. You don't have to think about the exact name or the appropriate name or make it an analytic thing and go through the checklist of all the possibilities until you get the right one. It's kind of like, what's the most obvious and simple thing there? You know, what's, and if there's nothing that's really obvious and simple, then you just will give it a generic name. Maybe you just kind of choose a few, like experiencing, I'm having experience, or life, or, you know, one that I use sometimes was yes. Just, you know, it seemed like a nice thing, just yes to whatever arose. And you know, I say this in an introductory course, you know, since ancient times, human beings have recognized the power of naming things. And it's often shows up in many cultures' myths. You name the dragon, and the dragon loses its power over you. You name the witch or whatever, and loses its power. Or in those cultures where you're given a birth name, but you're not supposed to tell anybody your birth name. You have a nickname. Because if anybody finds out what your birth name is, they'll have some kind of power over you. So you keep your birth name secret in some cultures. The Buddhist version of this can be seen in the story I like telling, I tell it often, of Mara coming to see the Buddha. And as I tell the story, you know, Mara is the Buddhist deity of temptation, of kind of evil. It's kind of like the Buddhist devil of sorts. And then what Mara hates the most is for people to get enlightened. The kind of job description of Mara is stop people from getting enlightened. And so the night of Buddha's enlightenment, you know, Mara gets really upset and anxious. So Mara tries his utmost to try to prevent the Buddha from getting enlightened. And the happy end of the story, the Buddha conquers Mara. The word Mara also means death. So it's kind of a pun or kind of double meaning. So he conquers Mara, he conquers death with his enlightenment. And you would think that, Mara never bothers the Buddha again. But what's very interesting to me is as the scriptures that record the Buddha's life, in those scriptures, after the Buddha was enlightened, Mara continues to visit the Buddha. In the same tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, in this early tradition of Buddhism, it very clearly says that Mara is really a personification of inner psychic forces. It isn't like this kind of strange deity out there or demon out there. But it's really kind of a way of talking about what goes on within us by personifying it. And that seemed very strange to me that Mara should continue to visit the Buddha after he's fully enlightened. You think after someone's fully enlightened, that's it, right? And, you know, happily ever after kind of scene. Spiritual fairyland, fairy tales. But Mara comes back, keeps visiting. But what's significant is not that the Mara is the same as us after all. I mean, not that Buddha is the same as us, because we have these things also. What's significant, what makes a Buddha a Buddha, is not that he or she has these things coming back, but rather how a Buddha responds to them. And each time that Mara appears in the life of the Buddha, after his enlightenment, all he says is, Mara, I see you. And Mara runs away. He doesn't tell Mara go away, or doesn't scare Mara, he doesn't invite Mara for tea. He just says, Mara, I see you. Just have, you know, this very matter-of-fact acknowledgement. This is what's happening. I see you, acknowledging what's going on. So this is the Buddhist version of the story of, you know, the demon loses its power when you name it. Now, I know there's often a lot of resistance among many people, or even mistrust of naming. Of doing this practice of naming. They prefer to do a mindfulness practice that's silent, doesn't use names. And I thought Bill's comment was very, very important, is not everyone thinks so much with words, but rather thinks more in images. And maybe for those people, the naming doesn't work as well as it would be for others. So you have to be aware that it doesn't always work for everyone, this practice. It's not necessary. But in addition to that kind of issue, there's a tremendous mistrust with some people in our culture with the process of words, with language, with labeling things. And you hear, I often hear such comments as naming things or describing them or verbalizing them or using words or language separates me from reality, makes me more separate, and doesn't really help me become more intimate and more close. And perhaps this kind of sense of mistrust is described in this book by Rachel Naomi Raymond, Kitchen Table Wisdom. Sometimes the naming or the noting is called labeling, mental labeling or mental noting. But she writes here, kind of in a very different context, she writes, "A label is a mask life wears. We put labels on life all the time. Right, wrong, success, failure, lucky, unlucky. And these may be as limiting a way of seeing things as diabetic, epileptic, manic depressive, or even invalid. Labeling sets up an expectation of life that is often so compelling we can no longer see things as they really are. This expectation often gives us a false sense of familiarity towards something that is really new and unprecedented. We are in relationship with our expectations and not with life itself." And we know that this can often happen, right? And we've all been maybe the brunt of being labeled by someone. And they see us through a label, and it's not really who we are. And we say, hey, wait a minute, hey, pay attention. There's a person here, not a label. And certainly a lot goes into labeling. And I was struck that the first example she chose for labels is right and wrong, and good and bad. Those are value judgments. They're putting values on things. And perhaps some of the mistrust around labeling or naming is that we so quickly will spin onto those words, those names, values, the judgments of good and bad, right or wrong, and all these kind of ways in which we put values on things and measuring things. The idea of naming as a practice of mindfulness involves no judgment at all of what you're experiencing. It's not labeling, sitting there saying, oh, this is good, this is good, this is good, which is a judgment. It's rather, oh, there's smoothness in my experience right now. There's ease in my experience right now. Oh, there's pain in my experience right now. There's no judgment. And part of the value of the naming and noting, it actually can give us a kind of a warning or kind of give us a sense of when actually we've crossed the line from simply calling things as they are and adding all our judgments and expectations on top of them. And the training of noting is a training in learning how to recognize and be present for things without judgment and criticism and wanting and desiring and all the different spins we can have on it. It's a cultivation of non-judgmental awareness. And so we try that. We say, oh, it's pain, pain, pain. Oh, it's joy, 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 joy. And we can learn this kind of a balanced way of being with experience this way. And it's interesting sometimes in mindfulness practice to listen to the quality of the inner voice that's doing the noting, the naming. And that sometimes I can tell you when you're kind of imbalanced with the experience. Because if you're sitting there with physical pain, and you're going, oh, pain, pain. That tells you something. Or if you're sitting there and you have joy and you go, oh, joy. You've gotten involved in experience, and it's not a balance, very simple kind of non-judgmental recognition, oh, this is what's happening in the moment. So it's very important to distinguish between the simple recognition of what is happening in the present versus assigning a value on it, judging it. And I would say that spirituality or Buddhist spirituality doesn't divide up the world we live in between that which is acceptable, unacceptable, or right or wrong, or good or bad, but it does discriminate. Now, discriminate maybe is a strange word to use because it has pejorative kind of connotations, but prajna, which is often translated simply as wisdom in English, is more appropriately translated as discriminating wisdom. It's the wisdom that can really discriminate one thing from another. To see differences and distinctions, distinguishing wisdom, is really necessary for wisdom to develop. And distinctions happen partly through seeing clearly without dividing up the world through judgments, good or bad or whatever we do. But oh, this, you know, seeing very subtle differences. And so the precision of noting can really help the precision of the mind. Many people want to rest in their practice in some kind of generic or general sense of calmness or peacefulness or intuitive kind of presence or whatever. And those are fine things to do. But for mindfulness to really to be used for its full power, really when develop mindfulness, so it strengthens our capacity to see particulars, to see really fine, refined details of what's arising in the present moment. So it isn't just kind of just say generally, oh, I'm here with my breath in kind of a general way. But you really, maybe as Chris said, you really get in there and you investigate very carefully. What are the details of this breath? And what are the detailed phenomena? So that the continuity of mindfulness is not kind of a general kind of continuity, but it's really specific. Because it's only in the specific of experience that we can see that the experience is constantly changing. But if we stay kind of global with the experience and kind of stay with some general sense of ease or calmness or intuitive sense of presence, it's harder to see that the changing nature of the present experience, out of which wisdom arises in the Buddhist tradition. Now the note, oh, well, forget it. Note, the idea of noting is not to separate ourselves from the experience, but the idea of noting is one, to help us stay in the present as an anchor to the present. But the other idea of noting is to help encourage us to be more fully present for what we're having. Not to separate us, not to create a barrier or a veil between us and the experience, but rather to nudge the mind, the awareness, to be closer to what it actually is happening. So I describe sometimes the naming as creating a frame around the experience, so you can really see it more clearly, be more, kind of, you're encouraging yourself to be more present. A soft frame around the experience. Now, one of the ways in which naming can create a veil or separation is if we spend too much time thinking about the right name. So we need to kind of just do the obvious. If nothing's obvious, kind of maybe forget it or do something generic. The other way is if we make it too loud. In the way we talk to ourselves in the mind, we make it too loud. It's kind of like, rather than just softly kind of naming it, it's kind of like we have a hammer and we go, pain, or, you know, joy, or you're really screaming it in our head. And what the art of noting requires us is to try to find a really subtle layer of verbalization from which we can speak to ourselves about the experience. I think many of us have the experience that we have different layers of intensity to our thinking process. You know, if you're really frazzled and upset about something and furious with someone, the intensity of the way you think, you know, is quite, you know, maybe the little skull is not enough to contain it. But then, you know, you had a wonderful nap and you kind of, everything's, the temperature's really calm and you're underneath this beautiful tree and springtime and just everything's going really well and you're kind of really calm and relaxed. And the mind, you know, is not screaming, but it's kind of really kind of a subtle kind of hum, whatever. So if you have the sense of different layers of intensity of your thinking process, the idea with the noting is to try to identify or find the most subtle layer that you can find, have access to, and name from there. Because if your naming is too coarse, it does get in the way. So sometimes I describe it as imagining that you kind of, as a soft whisper in the back of the mind, the back of the skull, almost as if there's a light feather, very, very light feather that's kind of brushing the back of your skull or the back of your brain, ever so softly. That's the kind of the intensity of these notes. Because primarily what the noting is doing, oh, and another kind of classic description of noting, of mindfulness, is 95% of what we're doing in mindfulness is sensing and feeling directly what the experience is. 5% of what we're doing is noting, is naming it. The naming is just a very, very subtle kind of nudge to encourage us to stay present. It's kind of like using our thoughts, which tend to take us away, to help us actually stay present. So it's using a very, very simple, rudimentary, kind of basic kind of ability of the mind to name the experience for what it is. So the thinking mind is a little bit occupied, teeny bit, so that the thinking mind doesn't take a vacation. and go off someplace else with you. So 5% we're doing is naming. So it's very, very subtle and gentle. And primarily what we're doing is sensing and feeling the breath, the details, particulars. Feeling the breath within the breath, feeling the body within the body, the feelings within the feelings. But very gently labeling it. I wanted to read this passage. This is a psychologist's article on grief. Grief and the mindfulness approach. Death, dying, and bereavement counseling. It's on the I got this off the internet. I was in a university library and they had in the reference room, they had computers, they had access to the internet, to the World Wide Web. I'd never been on it before. So I jumped at the opportunity and so what did I look up first? Buddhism. And I found this. And then this Malcolm, he's quoting another researcher who's writing about the use of mindfulness in the clinical setting. And the name of this person is Death Rage. An article on bereavement. And so it's kind of a clinical paper. So it says, Death Rage, 1982, has cited how the mindfulness method has been successfully applied in a clinical setting. One woman who was hospitalized for manic depression and schizophrenia was instructed to watch the second hand of a clock, and when her mind went off the clock, to name the distraction. Soon she realized that most of her distractions were related to the past. She was then instructed to label them as remembering. With this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbed thoughts instead of the objective thinker. Instead of the depressed thinker. So that was a very important statement. So, with this technique, she learned to identify herself with the objective watcher of her disturbing thoughts instead of the depressed thinker. So part of the value of naming is that when we name something, we tend not to be entangled with it. And I think we need to be very honest about how often we get entangled with our thoughts, our judgments, our fantasies, or whatever. And entanglement is often has a lot of strength to it. There's a lot of glue to it. There's a lot of oomph that we kind of invest in it. We invest ourselves in our thoughts and our preoccupations and what's important to us and what they did to us yesterday and what's going to happen. We invest ourselves in our plans for tomorrow. That in the way in which we invest ourselves with experience is what keeps us getting lost all the time, not being present. When we name things in a kind of calm, simple way, that naming in a calm, simple way is not investing, is different than investing ourselves, is different than being entangled. And when we can bring part of ourselves that's not entangled to an entangled situation, we begin unraveling it. And that's exactly what happened to this woman who was who was manic depressive and schizophrenic. I think it's really remarkable if this is true. She started labeling her thoughts as remembering, and they stopped bothering her as much because she wasn't so entangled. What?
It's just like the Mara story.
Yes, exactly like the Mara story. Buddhism is very repetitive. You say the same thing over and over again. Soon she began to gain insight into the nature of her illness and was released from the hospital. Another woman who was hospitalized for anxiety, depression, and inability to function adequately rebelled against any suggestion of introspection. And as she was a Mormon, the word Buddhist or meditation was not mentioned. As the therapist interacted with her, it became evident that much of her day was spent fantasizing and imagining to avoid the anxiety of her life. The habit of fantasizing was discussed with her, and then she was asked to undertake a psychological procedure. To her surprise, she was asked to bake a cake. However, she had to do it extremely mindfully, with minute attention to detail. When the persistent fantasies would arise, She was instructed to just observe them. After a while, she found that she could intentionally return to the present moment and so function more adequately. She also began to gain insight into the nature of her anxiety and depression. So this careful attention to detail, careful attention to baking a cake, careful attention to the breath. And of course the mind wanders away. It isn't just Basha whose mind wanders away. It's mine and all of ours. But when we start identifying and naming and recognizing that's going on, the degree which we recognize that, it's possible to get tremendous freedom from being entangled with it. And it's not automatic, of course, but it comes with time. It comes as we develop the capacity to observe clearly. The clear observer is not entangled. So what we're trying to develop is this disentangled, divested observer, so we can be freer and see more wisely, and paradoxically perhaps, or whatever, actually be more intimate with the situation. You know, our thoughts, when we get lost, separate us from real contact with the present world. When we can have this kind of clear, non-entangled observer, it's actually possible to be more in contact with our friends, with ourselves, and the world around us. So in mindfulness practice, we name a lot of things. Some people will name everything that arises if it's not happening all at once. You label the breath. Some people find that labeling the breath is not so helpful. And like Chris pointed out, it's all too easy to do, especially kind of a rhythmic, kind of repetitive naming, like rising, falling, or in and out for the breath. It's all too easy to that become mechanical. And you can go kind of mechanically go on and on and on, and you're off in Tahiti, you know, with your thoughts. So you need to guard, pay attention for naming becoming mechanical. It's supposed to be biological or organic or sensual or something. Some people don't name their breath, though the breath is the primary thing they're paying attention to, but they name everything that takes them away from the breath. So they name, thinking, remembering, pain, sound. And you name it as long as it seems to be compelling, as long as you're paying attention to it. Kind of slowly, very calmly, you know, thinking, itching. Restlessness, restless. I hate this. Hating. And just the idea is to constantly name unceasingly, uncompromisingly, just continually, calmly, straightforward, naming the experience. And with time, the mind that wants to rebel, and the mind that wants to judge, and the mind that wants to run away, will slowly, come into focus, both become tamer and tamer. The idea is to identify what's going on without identifying with it. That's a lot of what mindfulness is. Now, some of you will find that I'd encourage you to experiment with this. See if it helps you in your practice. Try it for a week or two or for a month. But if it doesn't seem to be right for you, you can just drop it. Or to name certain things. Maybe it's the things that tend to pull you away the strongest. Maybe some people I know only label their emotions, because that's where they tend to get caught. So they label their emotions, anger, doubt, joy, whatever it is. But physical sensations they can go to and be with very directly and simply. And one of the generic labels is just, you can just label something as something. Or just, yes. But when the mind becomes very subtle, sometimes the naming drops away. And then there's just a silent acknowledgement. The naming becomes just a silent acknowledgement. When my meditation, when it gets really subtle, sometimes I won't name anymore. But what I'll do is I'll just go, I don't even say yes, I just go, uh-huh. Kind of very, very, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just kind of aha things. Aha. Just some way of kind of very quietly, subtly acknowledging it to remind myself and to encourage me and guarantee that I'm really there for it. And sometimes it falls away entirely, and that's fine. And sometimes, some people it falls away earlier than others. As the mind gets more subtle in meditation, it's very important to shift gears with the noting and make the noting more subtle. What some people will find is your noting was subtle enough at one point in your meditation, but then your meditation, your state of your mind got pretty calm and quiet, and it got more subtle than the intensity of your labeling. And you can feel kind of dissonance then, kind of uncomfortable dissonance between the two. And then you need to kind of see if you can make the whisper of noting even quieter. And often it goes like this. The meditation gets quieter, and then you have to kind of feel dissonance and you quiet the noting. Meditation gets quieter and you quiet the noting until it might drop away. So names and language. In Zen they say that names and language can either kill you. They're very dramatic in Zen. Or they can give birth. And the trick is to use language and use names not to destroy things, not to destroy ourselves, but rather to use the creative potential that exists in names. Some things exist only because we've named them. So I'll end with a quote from Rumi. Every existence is poison to some and sweetness to others. Be the friend, then you can eat from a poison jar and taste only clear discrimination. So the idea is to be friendly to all that arises. And you can't be a friend unless you see it clearly. So thank you all.
Thank you.